Welcome to Upside Down Podcast. I'm Patricia Taylor, and I'm your host for today's episode. Show notes can be found on Instagram at Upside Down Podcast, and I want to give a huge thanks to our growing Patreon community who keeps this podcast free and free of ads. We really appreciate you, and we love the fact that as of now, we are still 100% listener funded. You can become a patron at patreon.com/upsidedownpodcast or upsidedownpodcast.com and click give in the upper left-hand corner. We have amazing incentives. We don't want you to miss them. And we also enjoy reading reviews from time to time. And that also helps our little podcast that could be found. So please share away if you are loving what you're listening to. Today, I am thrilled to be joined by another fellow podcaster, co-host of the Why Though podcast, speaker and author of multiple books, including her latest release titled Pray Tell, Why We Silence Women Who Tell the Truth and How Everyone Can Speak Up, Tiffany Bloom. Tiffany, thank you so much for being here and welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And so it's the morning time where you are. You are in the Pacific Northwest. Is that correct?
It is. And it is beautiful, sunny. I think it's going to get up into the 60s today, which is pretty rare for us in the spring. So I'm feeling it. It's beautiful. What about you? Where are you located?
Oh, I'm in Georgia, but I grew up in California. So I miss those like milder temperatures. Like a beautiful day. I'm like, it's already 80 and I'm sweating.
Oh man, the humidity. Okay, California to Georgia, that's like zero humidity to right. All day, every day humidity. That is no joke.
It's been quite an adjustment, but you know, yay for springtime. Minus the pollen though.
For sure. Yeah, minus the pollen. And Georgia's so stinking beautiful. So stinking beautiful.
Yeah, that's like the first thing I saw when we moved here. I'm like, trees, look at all the trees. So we are going to have a conversation today that is definitely not one to be taken lightly. However, before we go there, I do have to tell you that I freaked out a little bit when I saw that one of your features was being with the Hallmark Channel. Like, seriously, like everyone who knows me knows I'm a bit obsessed. I'm a Hallmarky. So I'm like, oh, that's so cool.
You like that's so Hallmark amazing. Channel. Oh,
I really
so
do.
Oh,
but yeah, it's just a little bit of an obsession.
You know what? If I had cable, I would have a problem. I just want to be honest. I'd be on your team if I had cable, but I am limited to Netflix and all of the login and passwords that my friends have given me illegally. So that is where I've had to
Yes. I mean, you know, they have the Hallmark app though. I'm just saying.
Not
that I'm trying to feed any, you know. But you have really quite the breadth and depth to your work and your ministry. I read this book. I'm so grateful to have been able to read this book. But why was writing this particular book important to you? A book titled, again, Pray Tell, Why We Silence Women Who Tell the Truth and How Everyone Can Speak Up. Why was this important to you?
It was important to me because I think so many of us, and especially when you bring in the intersection of race and class, so many women, we play by the rules. We honor the gatekeepers who have promoted us or employed us or made a way for us and given us opportunity. We've done everything culture, society, and even church has asked us to do and be, and we have still come up short when a man abuses his power at a woman's expense. And we see this across the board. We see it in education, politics, business, entertainment. We see this everywhere in every system that we operate in, that it's not a woman's resources or talent or connections or education that will get her the farthest in life. It's if somebody won't take advantage of her. And even Lean In, the organization that focuses on women at work, delivered this research recently that confirmed this idea that where there is a lack of accountability for men, women suffer in ways unrealized. They have such far-reaching consequences. So in my own journey in life, I was in between a rock and a hard place and spoke truth to power and found that the societal, financial, professional, and relational ramifications of doing so was a high cost to count, and I lost a lot. And so often women are seen as unemployable and unbelievable and disreputable and men are so easily forgiven. So with my own experience and watching what was happening culturally, I really felt led to address this issue. And I just want to say, Patricia, I am not this like charge the hill, everybody needs to listen. I'm this agreeable, diplomatic Indian woman who wants everyone to get along. So to talk about something so controversial has definitely been out of my wheelhouse, but I do believe that it's so necessary and so important, and half the world will suffer under the weight of oppression if we do not address it.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. So you name this very, very clearly, and you even give a bit of a disclaimer at the beginning. This is a book that does not shy away from the fact that this is for protecting women against powerful men. And while those are not the only power dynamics, these are the vast majority. So what if there has been any pushback that you've received from men? Like what do they think? Are you just out to get men? Are you just a man hater? Is it not all men? I mean, what's that reception been like for you?
It's been small. I will tell you that. I think, and I know you've read through it, and so you see how my desire and my goal is that men and women would see themselves as partners in addressing this imbalance of power and architecting safer and equitable spaces for all. But I have gotten some wild feedback from men who accuse me of being Hitler and being intentionally divisive. And this isn't some feminist manifesto where women get to lord over all. This is a heart and a longing for men and women to work together where everyone is seen and valued. So I definitely have gotten the haters, but I'm like, did you actually read it?
Read it.
it's not what I said. And I'm very forthcoming in the fact that the majority of promoters, mentors, and leaders in my life have been men. And they have leveraged their platform, their resources, and their connections for my benefit and for my professional growth and personal growth. And then others have exploited that beyond all reasonable belief. And so there isn't this belief that all men are monsters. It's understanding that those who abuse their power, which we can talk about, there's a very predictable pattern of how that happens and why there is such a necessity of accountability, because we can stop this from happening. But really understanding that power dynamics are so important to recognize, and also to give language to both men and women of how we can address it.
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, well, you just led right into it. I think I was saying this before the call, but myself and our other three co-hosts have been having a lot of conversations behind the scenes about what we see as a general lack of accountability, in particular within the church. There have been more recent revelations when it comes to Carl Lentz and Ravi Zacharias and allegations against the Exodus Road. But we can go back a year and name names. We can go back 2 years and name names, 10 years, 5 years. And sadly, we can look forward, not look forward in a good way, but we can look to the future and know that there will be more coming. So this episode is centered around the necessity of accountability. How do we as the church explain why there's such a lack of accountability when it comes to men in power and men who abuse that power?
Yeah, I want to point to the Old Testament here and looking at the example of David and Abishai. David, before he was king of Israel, he has fled from Saul, who wants to kill him. And he's in a cave with a sleeping King Saul. And his armor bearer, the man charged with carrying his weaponry, says to him, "Here's a sleeping Saul. I can take him out in one shot with this sword." And David responds, "Don't touch the Lord's anointed." And he was not referring to this belief that he believes that King Saul is free of accusations or dissent. He's saying, "Don't cause physical harm to a sitting king." Mm-hmm. Now, in our modern day, and just as you so beautifully and eloquently said, we can go back 10 years, 20 years in the modern church era and look how that passage and other passages like it, but that one really sticks out, how we have labeled all leaders, we've extended this to beyond pastors and the clergy to presidents and politicians and businessmen, but specifically in the church, we have slapped this "don't touch the Lord's anointed" over leaders, meaning they are free from dissent. You cannot come against them with any sort of charge, accusation, or experience that would make them appear anything but positive. And there's usually henchmen, we'll call them henchmen for just because the term is so vivid. There's usually
I like that word.
There's those who will defend. And those who come with accusations are told, not only don't touch the Lord's anointed, but you'll hurt the witness of the church if you do. You are a traitor to the gospel. You are against a good man of God. You are part of the attack of the enemy. So we've weaponized scripture. We've taken it out of context and applied it to those in leadership to believe that if they have been appointed or anointed, which is really only an Old Testament term, and that's only something we see in the Old Testament. Once Jesus comes, no one's appointed or anointed anymore. That, again, is very Old Testament. Yet we treat them as if they are a King David or a King Saul, that they have ultimate power, that they are the top of the hierarchy. And it is ever so dangerous to everyone involved because we are giving so much power to one person, and then we're insulating them from any sort of dissent that would keep them accountable. Now, there's a reason you don't, I mean, this happens in corporate America, but there are boards and HR teams and the EEOC to keep from this happening and to remove men from power if they overstep. Now, that's happening more and more, and I'm so grateful for that, especially since 2017, since the start of the Me Too movement. But interestingly, why does this happen more in faith spaces, you ask? It's because we have given this air of spirituality and this air, this pompous air, if you will, of holiness and righteousness that is untouchable. And then when also, if this faith leader has been benevolent, generous, or kind to us personally, we have this positive faith experience with the divine at their behest. So of course, there's no way that they could do anything below the belt. There's no way they could do anything vile or evil because they have been good to us, because we have had a good or generous experience and they've led us to that. So we are employing a confirmation bias as bystanders if we know this person, whether we know them in personally or whether it's from a distance like a Carl Lentz or a Bill Hybels or Andy Savage or fill in the blank. We think, oh man, he's such a man of God. He couldn't have done that. He has a family. We watch their public sorrow play out and it draws on our empathy. Yes. And again, we employ that confirmation bias, meaning we mine our own brains looking for data to confirm what we already believe about somebody. And if we already believe that they're good, kind, generous, benevolent, we'll do anything to continue down that neural pathway because we don't want to believe that we place trust or allegiance to someone who didn't deserve it, because then we've got to look inward and consider how we offer our trust, how we offer accountability, and how we offer that allegiance. It's much easier to believe that it didn't happen. It's an act of self-preservation. Surely a woman did something to deserve something, because if she didn't, it could happen to me. That's the just world hypothesis. Everything is as it should be. Mm-hmm. And if she didn't, then I have to address this whole system. I have to admit that this whole system could be corrupted. And that, my friend, is a lot of work to dismantle and rebuild.
Wow. Yes, that is... Ooh, there you have it. I mean, but the thing is that because within what you said, there are so many layers to this, because the person who has been victimized is trying to reconcile just what you said. I had these encounters with the divine at the behest of this person who I trusted to lead me. So then what's wrong with me that I didn't see this? What's wrong with me that I didn't get out when I should have known better? What's wrong with me that I let this happen? And then you have others around you, male and female, and you talked a bit about this too, just how difficult it is when there are other women who don't believe you. And so if someone who is, whether it's an abuse of power in an emotional way, sexual way, a spiritual abuse, any and all abuse, forms of abuse, people see this person in a particular light. And you, rather than being seen as someone who is coming in, bringing accountability, coming in, trying to point to a problem so that the problem can be addressed, you're seen as rocking the boat. Mm-hmm. You're seen as, that word again, I've heard it myself too, being divisive. You're seen as the problem rather than someone who could actually be the key to a solution so that this does not continue to disintegrate into a situation where people go on and on and on being harmed by an unhealthy, unrepentant person who's in charge. And I think that what's so insidious about this is that when you're in a situation in a church context and you leave a church because of this, how many people really ask the questions as to why? Like, it's often this, you know, blame game, the shame game. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, mm-hmm. that person left. They must have done something, you know, because we can't even imagine we're here having this great experience with so-and-so. So they must have, I don't know, they're too much. They were not compliant enough. They challenged too much. They undermined the authority, whatever it is.
That's right.
And, you know, I've heard time and time again situations, and in the work that I do, I work, Tiffany, with Be the Bridge, and we do anti-racism education and work, and I oversee a group of BIPOC participants, and it's just heartbreaking how many situations of spiritual abuse and racial abuse there are, and when someone approaches the leadership and says, "I don't feel safe here," rather than saying, "How can we make this a more healthy and safe environment?" It's, well, the problem must be you. Here's the door.
Yep. And assuming that they're emotional, insecure, immature in their faith, all of these labels to, again, protect the powerful versus listening to the powerless and being willing to balance that imbalance that's already present. I want to go back to something you said that I loved. You said, we can't believe that this person did something bad. And we must remember, those who are charming and have a level of leadership, they likely know how other people operate and how other people see them. Mm-hmm. And they're often banking on empathy. And one scholar calls it himpathy, because it's often from men and women. We are more likely to give a perpetrator, an abuser of power, empathy than somebody who's been harmed. And even when we have all the facts, isn't that wild? That empathy just comes out of us because we see this person who is so charming, and we're seeing their sorrow play out in public, and that pulls on our heartstrings. And we just can't imagine anybody losing everything because they made a poor choice. But what we don't see is the harm already caused and the lives already destroyed, because those are private and that should be private. But the fact is, if this person has committed sin, and we need to call it what it is, a crime against somebody else, then there has to be that accountability, and there has to be restitution. And this idea that it's so easily forgiven is, again, a misuse of Old Testament and New Testament passages, where we're encouraged to offer quick forgiveness. And we must remember, forgiveness only comes after repentance. There's no room to forgive somebody who doesn't have a repentant heart. Now, I think we can forgive for our own well-being, but the idea that we would reconcile or move on from something when there isn't clear repentance or lament is truly spiritual abuse.
Oh my goodness. You're all up in my notes, Tiffany, because I knew it was coming. I knew it had to be there. But if you don't mind, I just want to read just one brief paragraph, because there's so much to your book and I want people to read it and buy it. But on page 83, you talk about this and this idea of reconciliation and how it's weaponized against victims. So you say, "For years, I've heard from pillars of the faith that reconciliation is one of our primary objectives as followers of Jesus. With that as a central value to the Christian faith, I felt as though my refusal to reconcile with those who've abused their power would be a mark against my maturity rather than a necessary boundary in place to protect myself." And that has a big yellow highlight on it because boundaries are healthy. Boundaries are necessary. Boundaries are important. But oftentimes, and your book does not just stay within the church, but this is where our conversation is mainly parked for today. But oftentimes in the church, boundaries are frowned upon, as if to say, just like you wrote, that you must be doing something wrong if you need boundaries to begin with, or you're not mature enough because you just can't work it out with someone in the way that you should, because this is why Jesus came back. Jesus came back to reconcile us. And if we are truly followers of Jesus, then that is one of our primary tenets as believers. And so this, again, is so deeply embedded and rooted into so many of our theologies, just as this whole idea of honor and respect. That's the only thing that matters. You don't ever question the man of God. How then do we break out of those cycles? Like, how — you're here now, but how did you get here? Like, how do we — whether you grew up in this, or whether it's been the last 5 years, whether it's been the last year, it doesn't really take long for this idea and these identities and these beliefs to get formed within you. How do you end up where you are today, being able to reflect back on what was harmful and what was unhealthy?
Oh, what a great question, Patricia. I think when you look in the Gospels and you see the upside down kingdom of Jesus, where he addressed the leaders of the church, he addressed the Pharisees more than really anyone else. He constantly called them to the carpet for their abuse of power. And I'm like, man, here I was constantly told I need to honor and respect above all, just like you said, stay under that scepter of protection and stay under that umbrella of grace that is only offered by a place of worship, and how easily that is abuse couched in spiritual language. And so being willing and being able to step back from that really started when I looked at the life of Christ, and when I saw how he leveled hierarchies and he invited all to be seen as equal, and that there was equity there. And when you look even at the early church and they met in homes, there wasn't this top-down leadership. There was people for sure picked out to ensure that, you know, the logistics were happening and to give the word, but it was extremely, extremely equitable compared to what we see in the modern, especially in the Western North American church. It's like, this looks nothing like its roots. Now, do we want all to know the life-saving knowledge of Jesus Christ? Absolutely. But my grace, when we look more like the world, when our hierarchies and are in the patriarchal, androcentric ways of operating in the church look more like business and entertainment — and you, girl, I'm about to go off, I'm so sorry — and capitalism,
then does the
life of Christ, the life of Yahweh, then I think that there's room for change. So for me, I played by all the rules that evangelical church set, and then I was smashed by them. I had nothing left. In my situation, I was the breadwinner for my home. So when I spoke truth to power, not only did I lose my income walking away from that — I mean, we live in America where healthcare is tied to our job, so I lost my healthcare, I lost my faith community, I lost everything. So to play by all the rules set out for me and to do everything that I was told, until my loyalty to my convictions outweighed my loyalty to an institution, that's when I lost. It was just this moment of really, I gotta be honest, looking at the whole kit and caboodle and being like, Lord, where are you in this? And what does it look like to rebuild and have you at the center and not let it be defined by culture or patriarchal narratives or dominant culture, but truly to be seen and known? And I'm a woman of color and an immigrant, and my son is adopted from Uganda, so we've got a little United Nations thing going, and my youngest is mixed. And so, like, what does it look like for us to live out your gospel call in a way that is one of peace and wisdom and truth, and not to look like the way of the world? And so it really was looking at the life of Christ and then walking into spaces where, before I decided to commit, I needed to know, what does accountability look like here? I just have to say, when we went church shopping, I just remember thinking, like, man, I'm here, I am sending to the info@vanillachurch.com. Hey, what is your accountability? Where's your stance on women? What do you believe about the structures? What is your reporting system if there is abuse of power? Like, these are — it's not like, hey, tell me about your children's ministry.
Right.
I need to
tell
know.
Me about your choir. You got to get
tell me the choir. Yeah. When is the potluck? No, I'm like, tell me how you structure and who is overseeing the staff. I want to know who above you exists, and like, I need to know who is accountable to who. And it was one of those, like, well, let me talk to our lead pastor for you. I'm like, yeah, put him on the phone. I need to know. So yes. I think so often we want to belong, so we go where we feel a sense of belonging. And often that is preyed upon. I hate to say that. I know that that's very frank and very cutthroat. But if we were to step back and think, I want to belong in a safe space. So that's going to require accountability at the highest level. Mm-hmm. That's going to require women and minorities to be seen and heard, not just in a performative nature, but to truly have power at decision-making tables. Mm-hmm. Is there equal women to men on all of these teams, ad hoc teams, boards, you know, elder boards, whatever it may be, asking those questions and being willing. I know it's uncomfortable, listeners. I know it, but you deserve as an image bearer to belong in safe, equitable spaces, because the honest reality is this is happening in so many churches. Just as you opened with, Patricia, we don't need to wait even another quarter before we hear a story on Christianity Today. This right. is now every week we're hearing a leader abuse his power at a woman's expense, at a minority's expense. And so if we can see these very predictable patterns of how abuse of power happens and how those puppets of the patriarchy, if you will, protect and mm-hmm. allow it to fester, those systems happen, because abuse of power does not happen in a vacuum. It is predictable and it is widespread, and there is complicity in all levels. And often we are part of that. So we even need to consider our complicity. Are we going to let things slide because we don't want to raise a fuss? Because even that is a level of complicity that all of us need to take a look back. So when we want to do this right, we got to ask the hard questions to people in power and be willing to understand that if their answers don't match up with our values and our convictions, it's okay to walk away, and that there are safe spaces. And number two, we need to consider our own complicity and how that we have been perpetuating unsafe spaces for women, and specifically for women of color.
Right. Yes, yes, yes. Tiffany, my mind went to like three different places, like ping, ping, ping. Because I'm trying to hold on to it, because what you said is so true and so necessary. I'm thinking about asking the hard questions, and how many of us have just simply grown up with the idea that we don't ask questions, we just go in trusting. You know, we go in trusting a system that is man-made, man-created, man-run, man-led. And somehow apply that if we have a lack of trust, or if we are doubting something, if something doesn't feel right, if we're sensing something is off, if we're not getting those answers, then we somehow apply that to our faith as a whole and to our trust in Jesus. Yeah. And no. Like, we all are imperfect humans. Like, we all are flawed humans. And when we see that safety is lacking, that accountability is lacking, and those questions need to be asked, because even like you said, abusers are clever, they're crafty. Mm-hmm. You know, they can very say charming. They can absolutely say, oh, I support women, but only the right kind, only those who are not going to challenge, only those who aren't going to talk back or bark back or stay in their lane or stay in their place. So to have this idea that asking hard questions is somehow not trusting in God and in Jesus and not having enough faith is really dangerous. And also, you said something earlier too that really stuck out, when you said you played by the rules. And the question I've been asking myself a lot lately, just on my personal journey, is who made the rules? Who were the rules for? Who were they created for? Why are they in place? You know, but we get to this point of just accepting what's handed to us, because within too many church spaces and faith-based spaces, the act of curiosity in and of itself is frowned upon. You know, the idea of wondering, but why do we do this? But why is this like this? Is there a better way? Is there a different way? Can you explain this to me? I have some questions. I have some doubts. I'm wondering about this thing. And that's often frowned upon, because, again, it plays all in together. Who are you to question the authority?
That's right. And isn't it interesting how often you see in faith spaces the virtues that awarded a man power in the first place, the fruit of the Spirit and resiliency and creativity and faithfulness, he then sheds those the more he has access to power. So in his ascent to power, we start to praise leadership qualities, but in reality, they're often narcissistic tendencies. But we see those as valiant and necessary for the job. And in reality, they're agenda driven, where it's his way or the highway, get off the bus or get on the bus. This is the vision of God that God's given me. Mm-hmm. If you're not for me, you're against me, a lack of nuance. And I love how you said curiosity is frowned upon. And it really points to this idea that silence is maturity, that silence is spiritual. A very close friend of mine shared with me that a pastor he worked with said to him about a couple of color who came to the congregation like, hey, we know there's a lot of stuff going on with racial tension in America. We want you to know, like, we're not going to raise a ruckus. And he said to them, yeah, that's maturity. That's maturity. Ooh. And I about wanted to lit someone's car on fire. I was like, I cannot. Like, the idea that this white pastor who held so much power said, your silence on racial tension is maturity to this couple of color who, like all of us, just wants to belong and fit in and be in their church and be seen and valued for who they are. That was their coping mechanism at the time. And I don't assume to know what was going through their mind, right, or their family of origin or what they were thinking, but for them to make an appointment with their pastor to share like, hey, we're not going to raise a ruckus. Don't worry about us. We're not going to challenge you. And then for him to award them with this idea that they're righteous and holy because they're willing to stay silent. I just couldn't even. And that's just so, this idea that,
cringy.
It's cringy. Yeah. And this idea that we, again, we're willing to praise silence instead of doing the hard work of dismantling broken systems that are not of God.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then assimilation becomes more honored and valued than honesty. Mm-hmm. And going along to getting along becomes more of a priority and exalted higher than you just being able to show up and actually be yourself fully. And my goodness, is sad. It's enraging and sad at the same time.
Truly.
And you say this too, that silence is not spiritual and action is not optional. And this is true and very true. But like so many things, and you've named some in your own life, it isn't easy and it comes at a cost. And this is something I come across often in the work that I do with anti-racism education. There is a cost to speaking up and speaking out. You know, a year ago with the George Floyd uprisings and the protests that were happening, I mean, all of these friends were coming out of the blue, you know, to acknowledge the racial tension and all of the hard that was happening. A year later, most of them aren't even present in my life anymore because I keep speaking and because it makes people uncomfortable and other reasons that I'm sure I don't know anything about, but there is a cost to speaking up. There is a cost to this. So a lot of it is wrapped up in fear and just the knowledge of what is this going to cost me. So what would you say to those who are bystanders to an abusive situation who are maybe right at the precipice of making a decision about whether to speak up or not? And then what would you say to a woman who is a victim deciding on if it's worth it for her to speak up or not?
Yeah. So that first question, forgive the alliteration here, but I first feel as a bystander, because this is very much, I was the bystander in my situation, and this Pray Tell is very much written for a bystander, because that's 90% of us, right? Like, we're going to witness an imbalance or abusive power, and we're going to think, do I have an ethical, moral, or Christian obligation to do something? Or is this like, right, not my circus, not my monkeys type of sitch? Like, what do I need to do? And I first just believe that we have to have a posture of lament. If we are not willing to consider a posture of lament and one of humility and believe that this is happening, I cannot live in denial, because we spend so much time denying, we talked about confirmation bias and how we don't want to believe this is happening. But once we are willing to admit, women especially are being harmed by abusive power, are seen as unemployable, unbelievable, disreputable to the point that it's altering the trajectory of their lives. Like, I have to lament that this is happening to God's daughters, to daughters of Eve. And also considering my proximity to power and what I've gained from others being harmed, and how I have held on to a semblance of privilege that would allow me to put some blinders on and benefit from those in power in a way that others aren't. Recognize that imbalance has benefited me, or recognize that I'm neutral in this situation. So it is going to cost me to enter into something that maybe I didn't believe I had any business being a part of, but I must see myself as part of the answer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So from
right.
that posture of lament, we then have to listen. We have so many stereotypes in our head. I think especially women of color are particularly harmed by this, especially by pastors and magistrates. The court systems yes. favor white women's testimony over women of color's testimony. You can see that by sentencing. You can see that by consequences given. You can see that by HR policies. We have to listen to a woman's account of abuse of power, and we have to not offer our own judgment of how we think we would have responded. Mm-hmm. We are so quick to believe that our response would have been superior to hers, but we're again not taking into account her family of origin, her past experiences, her microaggressions, her trauma, her yes. belief about herself and God and others. So when we can simply listen without judgment, we can consider our body language, we can consider our facial expressions. And you know, it's interesting, Patricia, there's that punch of harm that happens to a woman, that abuse of power. But that second punch is all of us questioning, are you sure?
Yes.
But were you just into him? Are you sure it went down like that? Are you just emotional? Mm. Are you just unhappy? Do you just want to leave that place? Do you just not like him? All of that. It takes so much courage and bravery to tell your story in the first place and to tell the inconvenient truth. And research shows that only about 1% of women lie about these things, these abuses of power. So with that knowledge, we can simply listen. We not assuming guilty until proven innocent, but just listen. Mm-hmm. And then we have to learn how these things happen. In the same way that we are pursuing racial literacy, and I hope that this is something that never stops. As someone of color, I'm like, please, finally, everybody, let's all wake up to this and even wake up to how we've internalized so much of this. We have to continually learn how imbalances of power are not of God, and what would it look like to live those kingdom principles? And then finally, we have to pursue love as justice. Particularly in faith spaces, justice has been divorced from love and almost seen as vindictive in many ways, seen as divisive in many ways, seen as unnecessary. But restitution and redress when there's been an imbalance of power is necessary. Beyond a simple press release or an apology, we must see justice at all levels, not just for the perpetrator, because we'd love to believe that removing an abuser of power solves the issue in a system, whether it's the church, education, business, whatever. No, until we're going to readjust how that person was able to have an ascent to power with
yes,
unchecked accountability.
And to exist in the first place.
yeah. And who were those people willing to let it slide? Who was complicit in the process? Until we're willing to adjust and continue to tweak that system, burn down whatever's not working and rebuild, then this is going to happen again and again and again. So we must lament, we must listen, we must learn, and we must love as justice.
Ugh, I love that. That is like, so, that's so in line with what we do with our anti-racism education and leverage. Mm. We have to leverage our power and what we know. And the lament, I just want to pause here just real briefly, because I really want you to get to this next question too. I'm like, this conversation, we can keep going. But it's so difficult. I actually just heard this week, when this episode releases, you know, it'll be a couple weeks from now, but this week there's been yet another murder of a young Black man. And I just popped on a really quick live video that was being done by Oshita Moore. And and she said something that is true. And I hear it over and over again, and I say it over and over again. And on, to be honest, I get tired of saying it, but I think in particular, the white church and white evangelical spaces are so anemic when it comes to being able to lament. Mm. True. And that is truly, that's where we have to start. Because if we don't care, if we don't have empathy, if we can't enter into the pain of another human being, then what in the world is going to compel us to change anything? And and I think that that's something that we cannot overlook, the importance of lament. And then everything that you said, I am here for it. And it's so important. And they can't be divorced from each other. Like, it's all part of this process. And sometimes we so badly want things to just be step A, step B, step C, step D, checked it off. You know, but this is a process. And it's a process of undoing. And it's a process of learning. And I just wanted to ask you, as before you answer the question to the victim and what you would say to her in this moment, for those who are bystanders, would you agree or would you think it's a true statement that neutrality is complicity?
I personally believe it's violence, neutrality.
Yeah.
Violence.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And I think that some people just think that they're in somehow a space that gets absolved because they're just not on either side of things. I agree. Right. I think it's violence. And I just really want to make that plain because there are a lot of situations and we do need to all examine where we're culpable of situations where we are not speaking up and speaking out against things, but thinking that we are somehow off the hook because we're not the main one doing the thing. But we still have an opportunity to play a role in bringing about justice and bringing about a situation that's causing harm to the end of a thing. And so
when we abdicate responsibility, we are never in a place where we would consider lending our strength to those who need it. I think even in my own situation, I did not have the strength to speak truth to power and walk out the journey, a very uncomfortable rock the boat or get thrown out the boat journey, until someone lent me their strength and said, I'm going to walk this journey with you. You don't have to do this alone.
Wow. That's showing up. That's being there for each other.
Come on.
That's really powerful. And that's really our call as believers, right? If we, who's our neighbor? Who do we love? Who's our family? That's the question we asked in our last episode about kingdom economics. And we talked about money and capitalism, like you named earlier. But who do we consider our family? And what will we do for the people that we love?
That's right. So good. Well, speaking to the harmed, if a woman is listening and you are resonating and you are having just moments of remembrance of maybe a leader or a boyfriend in high school or a pastor or a mentor or a former coach, whoever the case may be, maybe your boss, whoever, I just want to remind you that you are not the sum of what's happened to you. We sit under the weight of the Greco-Roman influence that has saturated the early church, and we see it in our modern day, that has this implicit belief that women are second, that women are the presence of evil in the world, the early church fathers claimed. And that has manifested in this belief that women are not believable, that women are inherently untrustworthy, that a woman's voice and experience is not to be held at the same of a man's, and particularly a white man's. So I say to you, daughter of the king, I say to you, daughter of Eve, you are valuable. Who you are is enough. You walk with power. You walk with greatness. Hold your head up high. Allow others to lend your strength. You must not feel you have to walk this journey alone. It is not on you to move the line toward justice, but to walk alongside others and move it together, because this isn't a moment. This is truly a movement, one that will bring heaven to earth, one that moves the moral arc of the universe toward justice. Sister, I see you. I'm praying for you, and I honor your journey.
Amen. I don't think I can add anything to that, but amen. You know, Tiffany, I want to thank you for writing this book and for sharing and speaking truth to the situation, because I think anytime you enter into a space of someone else's trauma and abuse, and in this book, which I hope that you all will get, you know, Tiffany shares stories, real stories, and, you know, from corporate to Hollywood to White House scandals and personal experiences. It's difficult to enter into this space of someone else's trauma and abuse, but you did that, and you did that for the greater good. And so and through whatever it brought up in you as you were journeying through this process. So I just want to say thank you for that and so much appreciation for you being with us today. Could you tell our listeners how they can stay connected to you and, of course, how they can purchase your book, which will also include everything in our show notes?
Oh, thank you. You can find me on the Everyday at Instagram at Tiffany Bloom. And to read or listen to the first chapter for free, links to all your favorite retailers, book club discussion guide, and watch the trailer, you can do all of that at tiffanybloom.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Woo! This is a conversation that I really hope our listeners will take to heart, will chew on, and will be moved to action, whether it's to take a stand for someone who has been harmed and hurt and abused, or whether it's to have the voice and the courage and the bravery to tell their own story. So I just want to tell you all that you can learn more at upsidedownpodcast.com or where we live at Upside Down Podcast on Instagram. You are always welcome to join the Upside Down Together listener group on Facebook to process through episodes like this one with the lens of God's Upside Down Kingdom. And as always, we appreciate seeing you share our podcast episodes with your friends and online communities. Thank you again, Tiffany, and thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for having me.